From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
One, two, three, listen.
Well, welcome everybody to a slightly different edition of Are You Not Entertained? I'm Grant Williams, and I'm in New York this week, and joining me, as always, from the sunny shores of Lake Como is Roger Mitchell. Are you there, Roger?
Hi, Grant. Not so sunny today. It's actually snowing, but still on the lake. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure the snow looks better in Lake Como than it does most other places. So this is fantastic. People are going to love what we're about to serve up, which is the first part of what is going to be three individual parts of a conversation that we had in London in person, you and me, with three of our previous guests. Why don't you tell a little bit about how this came together and what it was all about?
Well, the three guests, Murray Barnett, Steve Martin, and Giles Morgan, we're very pleased with their individual interviews and suggested that we do a deeper dive, but face-to-face, if possible, on some of the issues that we managed to cover in their individual interviews. So we organised that for the Reform Club in London at the start of January, and we took a whole afternoon, and we were well-stocked with wine and beer. And we...
And tea, I hasten to add.
Yeah, a little bit of tea, not too much. And we went for 3.5 hours, so that's why I guess we're breaking this into three parts. And, you know, it probably fits quite well into three parts. The part we're going to hear today is about the industry. It's about the future of sports sponsorship, fan engagement. Is there still one fan, or do we have to segment it? The various sports, what their demographics are. I would call it pretty much a business of sport podcast. The second one, we'll get into modern content and everything we've talked about in previous months, Grant, about, you know, do the youngsters want something different, the 90 minutes or the 2 minute highlight package. And the third one is about how sport has touched their lives with various examples of what it's meant to us and how we got introduced to it and the moments that have moved us. So I think that's going to be a very, very interesting journey over the next 3 weeks for the listeners.
Yeah, Roger, you know, it was a fabulous afternoon. Great surroundings, great company, and a really, really interesting conversation. But, you know, before we get into the first part, there's one thing we have to touch on this week, and that is the passing of the great Hugh McIlvany.
Yes, indeed.
To me, an unparalleled talent in sports writing, and it sadly, with his passing, we've lost one of the true greats. But it gave the internet the chance to sort of eulogize him in the best way possible by reprinting a lot of his articles, and it just reminds you what a towering talent he was.
Grant, it is really interesting because I wonder. I don't know whether you agree. How the younger generations would have been affected by the news. Obviously, all of us, all of our generation, you could tell, massively, massively affected. Very nostalgic, very much bringing us back to a time that we did talk about in the Reform Club, a time when you compare great sportsmen, you even try and do that across the generations, you try and link it to your own soundtrack of your life, and that's something that Hugh McIlvany had a completely unique talent in, to take that tapestry and find a way to articulate it. And all of us that bought the Sunday Times and the Observer on a Sunday mainly to read his column, all of us knew that in a kind of like, you know, nodding kind of like in joke type way. But I don't know what the younger generation's made of all that, because it's so distant from what they consume now and what they want to consume. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because I think between the clear difference between the type of writing that Hugh made, or crafted is a better word for it, and the soundbite type stuff today, with this swing back that we're seeing, Rog, this move back towards long form content, you know, maybe this helps with the sort of renaissance of the McIlvany style of long, in-depth, beautifully crafted prose, and maybe his passing gives a whole new generation the chance to be exposed to it and realize what a joy it is on a Sunday morning to take time and read something almost poetic about sport, because to those of us that love sport, there is a poetry to it, and I think the modern style of journalism just doesn't do that justice.
You're right, although it was quite interesting, Grant, if you think about it. He was in a time where he had to be doing match reports, actual chronologically covering 90 minutes in football or 15 rounds in boxing, where we didn't have instant access to footage and things like that. He had to tell us, and it was really interesting to go back and look at match reports and how you could do that without it being very, very staccato. And then this happened and then that happened. He had this amazing talent to even make that sound so interesting. I don't think match reports can come back, but you're right, the kind of like op-ed deep analysis talking about the humanity of, whether it's the tragedy of Johnny Owens, or you know, the thrill in Manila, the 14th round, or Lisbon, or Matt Busby, all those articles that he wrote about, I think there is a market for that. And I think people will want to get closer to it and think that it's not just enough to have a controversial soundbite that, as they say, generates a conversation which ends up with people on social media just slagging each other off. That's not what we want. And hopefully Hugh can, as you say, swing the pendulum back the other way.
Well, it's interesting because what I've realised in revisiting some of his articles again this past week is that for a generation that probably won't even have heard of Matt Busby or Johnny Owen, but reading these pieces will make you not only wonder about them but care about them. I mean, such was the skill of his writing that you can't help but be drawn into the human stories and the people themselves, and that's a really difficult thing to do. So, you know, it's a tragic loss to the sports world. But I had this feeling that in his passing, perhaps he's going to kind of reignite a torch for quality long form journalism, and I can only hope that I'm right about that, Roger.
I think you are right. You know, I've seen a couple of models, business models, startup models in recent years that has got as a vision, you know, to go back to that quality. Almost as an opposite of what we're seeing today, and talk about doing that. And I think that's right. I think he can probably be a catalyst for that. I just really enjoyed, you know, forget all that stuff about. To be honest, Grant, if the youngsters don't want to read it, it's not our problem, is it? It's theirs. To be really honest, so like I'm not.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I'm not going to be bothered really about whether it is or not. What really got me is, you know, even hearing, you know, what his nephew wrote about it. You know, the son of William McIlvany, the great crime writer, the brother of Hugh, making a piece over the last couple of days on his uncle, and you realise that there are some people that truly can touch can touch readers with their prose. And McIlvany was like that. And, you know, he's Scottish. He was Scottish. And he did a series. He did a series that you can find on YouTube called The Football Men, where he talks about Shankly, Busby and Steen as the three exponents of Scottish football men. And he narrates it and edits it. And it's just wonderful. And, you know, it's a shame. You know, there's a feeling of end of era with people of such gravitas that are no longer going to be around, and we're left with use and throw away type journalism, type politics, type financial commentary, all for the days where people actually put in some work like Hugh did and sweated from morning to night over an article.
Well, yes, couldn't agree more. So rest in peace, Hugh, and thanks for all those wonderful words. Well, look, Rog, let's get into part one without further ado. You, me, Murray, Steve and Giles sat at the Reform Club in a beautiful book-adorned library-like setting, and let's jump straight into the conversation. Well, gents, welcome. Thanks so much. It's great to see put faces to names. Roger's met you all before many times. It's my first time. And thanks for joining us in this fantastic venue in the Reform Club. And we're going to talk all things sports. One of the things that Roger and I were really keen to do when we started this podcast was try and bridge the gap between fans and the business side of sport. Because if you're on one side or the other, you get a totally skewed view of the other side. If you're a fan, everything's negative about the business side of sport because it's changing something that you fell in love with as a kid. And I think if you're on the business side of sport, you kind of tend to rely a lot on data, which kind of takes the emotion out of the fan experience. So that was a big part of why I wanted to start this. So I think we'd love to kick off and talk about the business side of sports from guys who were in that side of things. We were just chatting now before we started about podcasting and how it's changing the face of the industry. So Steve, I'll kick it over to you because you were the last person to talk about podcasting before we started recording. Just talk a little bit about some of the podcasts that you're seeing coming through and how they are kind of shifting the landscape a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, they're very much on vogue at the moment. Podcasts seem to be and have evolved from nowhere. They were seen sort of as a very small part of the whole industry, and now it feels like they're not becoming a dime a dozen, but they're becoming very frequent. And I think podcasts are a great way to get across subjectivity. I think there's so much publishing in the market around the sports industry at the moment, which is very objective and it's very clear and clean and it's data-led and it's fan engagement-led and it's quite dry. After a period of time, it was all shiny and exciting when you talk about data 3, 4, 5 years ago. And look, it's incredibly prevalent and you have to understand it and you have to query it and you have to get insights from it. But it feels like the flair is missing sometimes. I think within the sports industry, it's in danger of sometimes becoming a little bit navel-gazing and self-congratulatory in a way. And I think podcasts allow just different opinions. You know, the sports industry and sport generally thrives on opinion. It's what makes it commercially successful. You know, fan bases debate the whole time about performance and bad performance on and off the pitch, on and off the track, on and off the court, whatever it may be. And I just think podcasts lend themselves to that incredible sort of, opinion-led pieces from within the industry, but also outside the industry. And I think one of the things that we'd sort of like to see more of is this sort of hybrid between what the fans are saying and what the industry's saying. And I think that's a terrific opportunity to find that sort of that sweet spot. So it's not one or the other, and it's not sort of shouting out there about things and hoping they stick. It's actually creating debate and looking at what's happening across all these sports from a fan perspective, because ultimately without the fans, sports are nothing.
Well, I to endorse what Steve's saying there is that the whole point of sport is about the fan. And the reason there is the money that there is in sport is because of the fan. And because the terraces are packed, because television audiences are huge, whatever it may be, it's because we all care with passion that is why the money people have come in, it's why sponsors have come in, it's why television came in. So when it gets too dry, gets too corporate speak, or when we're talking about whether it's private equity, whether we're talking about real finance, the danger is, of course, the fan gets cut out. And as you see when football clubs and all the rest of it, when it goes too far in one direction, the fan's voice tends to speak out. And therefore, I think podcasts like that, to Steve's point, is make it as subjective as possible, where if the fan is represented, the chances are that the money will follow.
Well, I think with the beauty about the disintermediation of media at the moment is that there are so many different avenues for people to get to fans or whoever their target audience is. And then the democracy is purely, you know, people don't like it, they don't subscribe, they don't listen, they don't watch. And, you know, back in the old days where you maybe just had subscription television and you were never really sure about exactly why people were subscribing to that service, and it was all this kind of alchemy, is now getting found out. And I'm sure we'll go on to talk about it. I mean, you see with, you know, people like Eleven failing with an OTT service in the UK, that's the ultimate example of, you know, people saying that I just don't care enough about that particular piece of content by itself to want to subscribe for it. And it's the same with podcasts. You know, I think that whether it's podcasts or any kind of published media these days, is ultimately if people are not subscribing to it or not watching or listening to it or reading it, then you'll rapidly find out whether it's been successful. And I think what that breeds is a lot more trial and error. And so it's not being afraid to kind of put something out there, try and see how you can refine it by letting your audience actually determine what are the bits that they've liked about it and not liked about it, and refine that.
And one of the other areas of that I think is a really good cue to why podcasts are doing well is that radio is going through an incredibly powerful revival. It's one of the most credible forms of not just marketing, but just general broadcasting. My sister actually heads up the BBC and radio offering in Northern Ireland, and just hearing what's happening there and the innovation that's coming through radio has a direct correlation here. And the debate around radio never goes away. Look at all the debate around the breakfast shows and where Chris Evans is moving, Zoe Ball getting this, and, you know, Talk Sport and Radio 5. Those mediums are not going away. All you ever hear about is about broadcast, and, you know, which I think refers to TV audiences. You never really hear much about radio, because radio is really hot. And it's doing very, very well, and it's super credible. So I think there's a direct correlation between podcasts becoming very popular linked to that.
And if you look at the BBC, say with a sport like golf, the guys from the BBC, so Andrew Cotter, they've started up The Cut, and it's going great guns. They've got their renewal. It's a podcast for golf tragics. It's very funny. If you like golf, it's humour. But they didn't think they'd get the funding. They begged and begged and begged to get the funding initially from the BBC, and it's just taken off, which I think is, to Steve's point, is really encouraging. People like to listen to stuff, providing what's coming out is both subjective, possibly witty, certainly educational, and of interest.
I think from our point of view, Grant, when we started this, we didn't want to be me too to anybody. You know, there's a whole lot of offering out there about good sports podcasts, sport business podcasts. And then there's the other side, which are really very much fan-led, whether it's Arsenal TV-like. And we tried to find a balance. And the guests, I think, have tried to show that, which is some players, people from the sports business, even an artist. And I don't know whether we've got the balance right. All I know is that the last one we did with Colin O'Donnell, my own son, who is, 16, 17 now, he really liked that one, you know? So I think what we've tried to do is find a small niche that is totally authentic. It might not have a very big audience that can identify with us particularly, but I think it's what we wanted to set it out as. And where it goes, I don't know. But, you know, every day we try and think, well, who do we need to have on next? Is it going too much on the business side? Are fans having a big enough voice? And, you know, today I think I'm hopeful that we get a little bit more of a steer of where we need to take this. It's never going to be a business. It's never going to be something we're particularly interested about, but in terms of making money out of it. But, you know, I think we would like to see it continue in 2019.
Well, there was one question. We're talking about the fan and the business, and it's something I've got to ask you guys, because I went to
I went to Burnley, of all places, for my father's 80th. It was his 80th birthday in Fulham. He's been a Fulham, lifelong Fulham fan, and he co-opted me into that particular little clan years ago. And it just so happened he was in Doncaster. We went to watch Burnley Fulham at Turf Moor. Now, it was a pretty typical Fulham experience. Miserable day, awful weather, terrible football. My brother, in fact, turned to me at one point and said, you know, I'm always going to remember this day as the time I had a nice pie. You know, the food actually was pretty good at Turf Moor. But we're on the way back, and I'm listening to 606 or whatever, I think it was 606, and they had a Leicester fan call in. Very well-spoken, knows a lot about the club, knows a lot about football, and he said, you know, Claude Puel's got to go. And the guy on the radio said, well, okay, why? He said, well, you know, he doesn't seem to be bothered about the result today. We should have done better. You know, he really has got to go. And the host of the show said, well, you know, realistically, where do you think Leicester should be in the Premier League this year? He said, well, look, you know, we should be 10th to 14th, something like that. And the guy said, you're 8th. And you think you should be 10th to 14th, you're 8th, and the manager's got to go. And he said, yeah, it's just, you know, the football's not good enough. We've just got to go. And I was listening to that, and I was thinking about this podcast, thinking, as guys on the other side of that who are trying to cater to fans in the best way that you can, how do you filter out what is always going to be that fan element that completely throws all reason out the window and just becomes a gut feeling about something you love or hate?
I mean, that's the beauty of sport, isn't it? Is that everybody's got an opinion. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a good or a valid one. And sport is about people's passion. And so, you know, we've all done it, called up in the heat of the moment or spoken to a friend and said, my team's rubbish, we should, you know, remove all the players and the coach, and then woken up the next morning and seen some sort of reason. But I think that the very fact that this person even called up to talk about it shows you how much passion there is in sport. And, you know, that's what the oxygen is of the whole thing, is that they have that desire to want to call up and talk about it.
And that's where there's a real conflict, of course, in sport. Is a true fan, whether it's in team sport, individual sport, understands there's a binary nature to sport. There's a win and a lose. But losing isn't always the worst thing for a fan. They understand it. They understand the draw in team sports or whatever it may be. But clearly in commerce, there's a dichotomy there, is that if you want to make money, you need to be successful. Therefore, win, win, win at all costs. A true fan at any sport, you can think of any football fan, they've gone through absolute years of harvest and years of absolute drought. And that's just how it is. It's true of rugby, it's true of everything. And that's the thing that the fan understands. Of course, the fan might always want to do a little bit better, but they understand they're not always going to be golden.
That Leicester example, though, is the ultimate thing that fans want is hope. That's all they have. Every start of every season is hope. And particularly if you're, you know, 18th in the league, or you're 12th in the league, or you're, you know, fighting for a top 10, or you're fighting for a top 6. It's all about hope. And you're, you know, back to zero for every new season. The Leicester example to me is just dreadful communication by the club and the manager itself. You know, I support Liverpool, right? I've never hidden away from that. It's all about hope. Liverpool have won nothing under Klopp, yet I am absolutely right behind them, whether they come first, second, third or fourth. And okay, it's not 10th to 14th, but it doesn't matter for Liverpool. They should be winning the league at some stage. But you're brought along by hope, but you're brought along by actions, and you're brought along by communication and the spirit, and you know, you back that. Now, there'll still be unbelievable debate, and there'll be highs and lows, and you'll be happy one day and moody the next, but I just think the Leicester example is, if they're sitting as eighth, their communication's dreadful. And maybe they're not bringing everybody along with them. You know, I look at Spurs, which is in Murray's team as well. You know, they're bringing people along with hope as well, and they're starting to change things. Again, quite honestly, not like Spurs of yesteryear, a bit like Liverpool. They're always challenging, and they're so frustrating. But the communication's got getting better and better and better, and it's all coming from these managers who are bringing the fans with them and the connection with the fans. You know, Guardiola was the master at that.
Steve, I want to come on to this point, because there was the thing that struck me when I led the Scottish Premier League, and I think the guys around the table were all kind of like people that think that we can win out. A reason with intellect. We might not get our own way, but we can have a debate, and normally reason wins out. When you run a sports body that is very high profile, like football and ones you've done as well, sooner or later you come to the point that you realise that fans are not rational. Or at least a very big portion of fans are not rational.
Sport by its very nature is about people's passion, right? And so you are always blinded by it in one way or another. Even rational people become blinded when they, you know, it's the cliche about, you know, you go to see Chelsea play and, you know, these very proper people, when they walk through the turnstile, all of a sudden become sort of neo-Nazi.
That's category
hooligans,
three.
Right?
That's category three. So, rational in the main, but in sport.
But there's something about when, you know, as soon as you put on your club colours in whatever sport, with the possible exception of, you know, rugby and golf, that you become a bit blinded as to, you know, your rational view on how the world works. But I think that, digressing ever so slightly, you know, one of the things that we do when we're looking at sports from a governing body perspective is, you know, you've already got those people that are super passionate about the sport. So arguably, you don't need to do very much to service them. They are already going to be on fire, whatever you do, good or bad. So what you're always looking to do is, what are those things around the sport that are going to help try and drag people closer into the center of it? So I think when we're thinking about how do we do a better job of communicating to our fans, the messaging that we're always looking to communicate is much more that macro stuff, because you accept the fact that people that can't see the wood for the trees are going to behave in a certain way. So there's no point trying to communicate directly to them, because they're never going to be rational about the way that they think about it. So you're much more preaching to those people on the sort of outer circles of the sort of concentric circles of passion, if you like.
I think this is really, really important, because, you know, when data-driven sport now says you know exactly who your fan is and you need to have an engaged conversation with each one of them.
But it still comes down to the conversation. And, you know, I don't know, I always get pretty shocked by that there's a surprise element to all this. It's, you know, what we do all for a living and have done for a living is, you know, we charge for knowing what audiences do and how they behave and how they interact. That's like if you can't plan around something, how they're going to react. You know, so you give the example of your segmentation, which that's pretty much your own segmentation. Yeah. But I like it. You know, and is that you have then a strategy to communicate with those segments to bring them all through. And the strategy might be, well, we're not going to engage fully with them if they're completely blinded by things. So you're going to focus on the core and let everything sort of grow from there. But it's the lack of planning, I think, is incredible around so many, particularly in football, I think, that there's a surprise element to it.
But I also think that many sponsors, partners are quite naive. You know, you go into any sport, you're going to get your segmentation or whatever you call the segments. And a lot of sponsors shy away from getting involved with the real fan for fear of somehow wanting to engage in a conversation. And I think the best sponsors, and I used to work with Steve literally a quarter of a century ago with some football brands. He was the football king. I had very little to do with it. But I learned then the lessons of how to speak to fans in a real way that was authentic. The client of Steve's and been part of his life for a long time was Adidas. And Adidas were very, very strong, as you'd expect from a football brand, of speaking, or a clothing and sports brand, but football being obviously their biggest market, speaking like the fan for the fan and being brave, often with humour. And it was something that I really learned. I remember it. I mean, it's a long time ago, which is sponsors need to be brave and represent at some point the fan if they want to engage.
You're absolutely right, but you know, to what Roger mentioned data earlier, and you know, people are calling data the new oil. It's not. Data is the new snake oil. It's kind of, it's actually, if you only ever actually look at the data to try and inform your direct your strategy, then you're going to get it wrong. You should look at the data to inform your strategy, but it shouldn't be the sole element. And as Charles says, you know, a lot of the time we see that sponsors or even TV broadcasters or anybody looking to commercialize in sport tend to just look at data in front of them and extrapolate their answers solely from that, rather than actually trying to get to know any real fans, or even, you know, as we were saying about earlier, taking a punt to let's try this and see if it resonates with people. If it doesn't, we can kind of tweak it and change it a little bit until it does.
Well, that's actually answered the question I was going to ask you, and which was, data is obviously so powerful, but you have to talk to fans and understand what that data really means, because how else can you do this if you just look at data? It doesn't make any sense to me.
I had my parents over yesterday. My dad was a diplomat, and my mum
didn't come through the gene pool.
my mum said that nowadays, you know, being a diplomat must be a horrible task. I said, well, why? And she said, well, because, you know, back in the day, it took, you know, 2-3 weeks for a communique to reach us about, you know, what we were supposed to do. So you had to get on and do it. Whereas nowadays, if you're managed in real time by London and what the politicians want you to do and so on and so forth. And the same is happening now with us, is that, you know, you can get sort of so caught up in the minutiae of all this data which is coming at you at real time about what's happening, without taking that step back and saying, actually, how do we, you know, how should we be looking at this in the whole, instead of what these little things, you know, mean as they come through, these little zeros and ones.
Murray, I want to come back to what I was saying before, because I think if we do believe that we're going through the word you used, disintermediation, unbundling, all these kind of elements, that means that the segmentation, whichever category you want to call it, you have to split up your communication, you know? So what I look at these days is sponsors, but also pay TV companies that are not splitting it up. They're still pretty much in the old model of bundling. How much they realize that they're going to have to change, and how much we think that that future is real, or whether we think that it's a little bit of a bluff. And, you know, I read, I think it was even this morning, that they're starting to rebundle subscriptions back together again. You know, my view is that the fan is very, very different. And, you know, if I'm a brand, I really don't want to pay for that 50% of the ones that are never going to buy my product or never going to be influenced by my product. And I'd like to make sure I'm not paying for that. And if I was coming to an agency, I'd be saying, how can you make sure that I'm not wasting half of my budget on a plan that is going to speak to people that I'm not really interested in? Is that real these days, or is this just business school talk about what's possible?
Well, I think there's a few different things kind of in there. But firstly, I think that the nature of media is cyclical anyway. So what we'll see is everybody's thinking that they can have their own standalone OTT services. Some will fail, some won't. And there will ultimately be mini Sky Sports that form over the next few years or next 5 years of reaggregating content. Because all of a sudden, if you're, to pick an example at random, I don't know, the British Basketball Association, and somebody comes along and says, okay, I'd like to bundle you with this other service that's already got 500,000 subscribers. I'm going to pay you pence on the pence for your subscriptions, because I'm giving you a much wider audience, but it's still probably going to be more than you'd make on an a la carte basis. You'd be crazy not to do it. And I think it's a question of perception, because then, you know, as a marketeer, you walk through the door saying, okay, I've got that 500,000 audience now. How much can I convert that audience into being at least sampling, you know, my sport or my thing? And I think that that's ultimately the way it's going to go, is kind of this disintermediation and then reaggregation eventually, you know, back up again. But I don't think that when you look at, you know, back in the days when I worked on ESPN UK, we only paid rights fees for about 4 or 5 things. Everything else was literally, if you want, you can be on our service for free, because we'll give you a slot, we'll guarantee you a slot, we'll even guarantee you a certain level of promotion, but we know that you're not driving our subscription numbers. And most of the time that they did that because they still knew that they were reaching a relatively wide audience. I think the danger is that people become very lazy and they say, okay, so actually I'm on a widely distributed sports channel. So I'm going to go to a sponsor now and say, I've got the potential reach of 5 million or whatever the number is. And in actual fact, you haven't, because your audience is still minuscule. What you should be saying is, I've created a great base for development, and how can you help me? You know, HSBC, you know, who Giles used to work for, did a great job of helping us when I was working at World Rugby, of like building up the Sevens to be something that greater than it was, right? Because they were willing to invest a lot of money in the promotion of Sevens as a sport, not just seeing what HSBC could get from it directly. I don't know if you want to touch on that.
I just think it's interesting, having been a buyer for a long, long time, but also having sort of been trained in the agency side, is that in the old days, the amount of bullshit and rubbish about TV numbers was extraordinary. And everybody knows who they are because everyone was doing it. There was the most extraordinarily vague model in the world. The exciting thing is, and it's exactly to Murray's point, is now it's much more quantifiable. Sponsors now can get a reality, whether it's through social media, whether it's through properly measured media. But that shouldn't be the be-all and end-all. That should be the base product, which then allows, whether it's sponsors and other investors, like private equity, to really make the money, which is called attracting the fan, because then you create that virtuous circle. And I think sport was quite lazy for a very, very long time, because it could be. Because effectively there were media channels, people watched television, that was a deal was done and sponsors would flock. Now it's much more complicated, but it doesn't stop. Where the value comes from is the fan. However they're segmented, however they're communicated to, if you get the fan right, I always think a very interesting model is the All England Club. You know, people would think Wimbledon is a sort of the stuffy doyen of British sport. It's arguably the most successful sports event in the world on a kind of fortnight basis in terms of people who attend, how they sell the rights around the world. But what they've done very cleverly is they've said, right, we know our product, we'll take it all in-house, we'll produce it ourselves, and we'll sell it on.
Yeah.
But they know their fan, and they've done more work on that than anything. They know who they are, and they know that when people come to the All England Club, whoever you are, people will behave in certain ways because they've created their brand. And I think that's... I always look to them as a kind of one of the real pinnacles of how powerful sport can be.
Well, I mean, the Masters is the same deal. I mean, they've done that for years, and exactly that same model. It's an incredibly powerful brand that they've just brought all of it in-house, including the manufacture of the sandwiches, I was told when I spoke.
I mean, the job we all want, I think, is the job, the liaison officer,
right,
that sits between Augusta and Wimbledon.
Right.
That is a job. But I think,
golf day one year and tennis day the other.
It's the greatest. I mean, I think, you know, I'm pretty biased towards the Masters. I think it's the greatest sporting event, bar none, of how they've protected it, how they've marketed it, how they understand their market, how they've moved with the times, that sort of juxtaposition of history versus innovation.
And Steve, they've been very brave in maintaining some of their standards, despite what society may say.
Completely and utterly protected, but really moving with the times. I mean, their digital product has been, I think, extraordinary, what they've done. And given, you know, the stakeholders around the Masters and the broadcasters around it, but actually just the members who really control it, they've got terrific vision. And as a live experience, there's nothing better. But I think how they've chosen to market it and have commercial impact, albeit with sponsor partners who are in there for hundreds of millions of dollars, except you wouldn't really know.
And who get retained again every year and pray that they... Yeah, that's right.
And Steve may be right in terms of, I've only been to the Masters once and it was a sort of mecca moment for me. But what I got very overexcited about was that the sandwiches and the beer were so cheap.
Yeah, £3.
The fan experience was subsidised so that the fan was never ripped off. It was quite expensive to get in. But once you were there, you were it was as special.
Joe, ironically, it's not expensive to get in if you get a ticket in the ballot. It's one of those things. But it's going back to what we're talking about is understanding your audience. I think that's the general theme I'm hearing here about understanding your audience. You know, and how you segment that audience, and how you communicate that audience, and choose to, you know, go. But also, what Giles was saying about the channels now open to us all. You know, you're saying obviously in the good old days, if you like, you know, it was about broadcast and it was about national newspapers and national radio. You were talking about five or six media outlets. If you had relationships with them, you essentially had a communication program to connect with fans. Layer on top of that, particularly in football, suddenly was through club websites, which were really static. I mean, look at the success of Perform. was purely based on finding a way to use club and football websites to connect with the fan base in a digital way. I mean, performers up, you know, for debate for another day maybe, but I mean, an extraordinary business.
We'll get on to it.
But I think choice and media channels have just exploded. It's probably made our job much less fun.
Well, much more difficult. I mean,
and much harder.
The level of content that you have to create now to keep your audience or prospective audience happy is just ballooned. Yeah. And I'm not complaining. I mean, I think it's great because it gives you avenues to be creative in other ways than you thought. You know, bring it all right back to the podcast that we talked about at the beginning. That's just another avenue that you can create that people can consume your product in. And I think that's great. But in the good old days, you used to just get the live product out, create a highlight show, job done, right? That was it.
Murray, I don't want to leave this too soon because I honestly think we need to look ourselves in the eye here. Let's look at football again, sponsorship. Outside the addiction business, betting, alcohol, it's never really succeeded, football. Never really succeeded. And, you know, let's take an example that I used recently with somebody in a workshop where you say to them, you're a proper brand, whether it's Apple or Samsung or something like that, or Mercedes, and you try and sell, you as the sport, you try and sell that brand, your sport, and they say, look, you know, to be honest, I don't really need official status. I don't need official status because I can buy your audience programmatically. I'm not really interested. And I think that's exactly what's happening in sports sponsorship. And I think the reply to that is, yeah, you can buy your awareness programmatically, exactly the audience that my sport has. But what you can't do is know the number of sports fans in my database that have got a car that's 2 years old and they should be about to change it, or a phone that's 1.5 years old and they should be about to change it. That's what I think sponsorship is now. And I don't think the sports industry has fully had the penny drop on that yet. Awareness isn't the game, in my opinion.
I think you're right, but I think we could probably spend the whole of this afternoon just talking about how much the sponsorship industry is changing, because it's completely different. And I think we're only at the start of a massive revolution in the way that it should change. And I don't mean sponsorship even just specifically for sports. I think, you know, globally, the idea of, hey, I just want to have my logo up there and get a few tickets to an event are long, long gone. It's interesting. We did a presentation fairly recently. In fact, I may have mentioned this on the podcast. We did a presentation fairly recently for a .com in San Francisco, and actually the brand awareness and the number of tickets they were going to get were literally the last slide on the deck, because that stuff is just so irrelevant now. And they're kind of like, oh yeah, we'll probably need some of that, but it's very much an afterthought. And it's much more about the authentic integration that sits at the front.
I don't think that's been talked about for 10 years. I think we're talking about a history lesson here. Are you what you're referring to? I mean, we certainly haven't talked about that for 10 years. And I don't know. I don't know whether it's not us trying to be clever or whatever. I can't think of any brand that briefs us. I'm sure it does, and it varies internationally as well. But I don't know. I look at the brands that maybe the ones we're working with, they're pretty sophisticated. They know what they're doing. They're trying to move with the times. They're trying to innovate all the whole time. But they're very, very, very aware. And the last thing they're doing is a badging exercise. You know, there's been too much debate within the sponsorship industry about one way to measure and all the rest of it. But everybody talks about the results, but a lot of people don't talk about the actual output. So the whole creative process to get to connecting with an audience is the flair bit. The data bit is the bit that helps fuel it. Talking about that and how you analyze that as part of a strategy, not the strategy. But I can't think of one campaign we've worked on in the last 4 or 5 years, which is about awareness. I can't think of one. I can think of every brand that we work with is about either customer loyalty. So the O2s of the world, the NatWest of the world, it's all about holding on and stopping churn. I think about brand love and brand sentiment, which is Coca-Cola. They don't need brand awareness. Certainly not. I look at Samsung. No, it's not brand awareness. It's about getting across their innovations. Heineken, even, it's not even a brand awareness thing. So it's very, very different. And I'm not saying those are pretty sophisticated brands that are well established. It's maybe very different than, you know, those examples within the betting industry, that the reason they're so aligned with football and there's so many betting brands aligned with football is because there's so many new brands desperate for a brand awareness, which has created a market within football to create high traffic, huge numbers of audiences, and they're prepared to throw the money at it.
Well, and what's very interesting, having spent a bit of time in Asia, as you'd expect with HSBC, I agree with both the guys. There's a huge level of maturity in the UK, probably the German market as well, and obviously the USA. I think in the Far East, you're still
and
seeing...
And continental Europe.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot...
Italy, Spain, I think.
A lot of badging. Yeah. A lot of badging. And the real opportunity is in the Far East, in terms of people are still measuring on the size of the logo and the stickiness of the logo, which of course is anathema in terms of what really means, what really constitutes success for big brands in particular. It's not about awareness, but they've got that. It's, do people care?
Well, I think,
are they part of the conversation?
I think you're right, but I think there's also a new trend which is developing in the sponsorship sort of industry or sponsorship marketplace, which is kind of soft power politics that's coming through. And, you know, on the one hand, in its most kind of prevalent form, that's the sort of the Gazprom being involved in the World Cup or something like that. But I think there's even more sort of slightly tangential ways in which that happens, where it may be trying to influence some political perspectives or views. And you see that in much more the kind of, you know, Visit Egypt, right? So Visit Egypt's involvement in the World Cup as a secondary sponsor was a direct impact of SoftBank and Vision 2030 trying to buy the World Club Championships long term. So, you know, they're not always completely obvious to you when you first see them.
Well, and I think any OCOG sponsorship of the Olympic Games, the domestic partners.
Well, and Samsung. Samsung's a classic example.
Are generally, there's a diktat from a government that will start saying to various sectors, we will count on your support. And there is a major nodding of agreement, and the deals flow very quickly. OCOGs are not difficult deals to do.
Back to the fan thing, because something when we were talking at the Masters really resonated with me, and that's this idea that once you're inside the grounds at Augusta, the pimento cheese sandwiches are $2 or $3 and a Coke is $1, and they've kept the prices incredibly low. And I interviewed one of the ownership group of the Atlanta Falcons earlier last year, and he took me for a tour of the Mercedes-Benz Stadium where the Super Bowl is going to be. I mean, it's an extraordinary stadium. But we were walking around, and they've gone to great lengths to build fan communities in and around the sort of the away from the seats. So you can stand there at the bar or the cafe or the fast food joint overlooking the game. And he said, we've done two things. We've made everything $1 or $2, no change. So we've cut time out for change. No one has to give any change. It's either $1 or $2 for a sandwich or a hot dog. And they did this. They brought the prices right down so that the fans would come into the stadium early and they'd spend 3 or 4 hours there before the games and spend probably more than they would have done anyway, but felt happier about it because they didn't feel like they were being soaked and having to pay $6 for a beer and $5 for a sandwich. And I just wonder how much the marketing side, the ownership side of sport are thinking about the fans who are seeing the prices of everything go up every year, and they're being targeted in every way possible. And I'm just interested to see where that is brought into the conversation.
But it's a wonderful opportunity, price point like that for a sponsor.
Absolutely.
Because prices do go up because there are costs. And without using HSBC as an example, because it's so simple, but one of the most successful things that was done at Wimbledon, where typically 500,000 people turn up over the fortnight, was that HSBC probably has 20-25% or 20% of the UK banking market, so quite a lot of those people by definition. The simplest thing in the world was for, if you had a card as an HSBC cardholder, you got free strawberries and cream.
Right.
And because the club are charging XYZ to the punter, and they're doing it for free, and it probably got more referrals for new business. Something is a £6 or £5, I don't know what a punter's strawberries cost, Wimbledon, probably £30.
Yeah, right.
But it's to exactly that point, which was a reward for being loyal, and you've seen
MasterCard in particular have
the
done
Masters
it.
And brilliant. Other events, yeah.
And Stella have done it. I mean, loads of brands, loads yeah. and loads of brands. And it is the simplest way, because most fans, just whatever the segmentation is, they know they're being fleeced with yeah. ticket and everything. Anyone who can expedite that becomes a hero.
But that goes back to your loyalty brief. That's a loyalty play.
Right.
In the same way as O2, you have the Blue Room at Twickenham, you know, same thing. It's those aren't new, but yeah. I think they're often overlooked. I just think in football is probably the worst, because of the amount of money that's exchanged, created around the game, and the profits that are now being created because of the broadcast money. How long that will last, we don't know. And the Premier League is the best example of that. I can't think of any big major fan initiatives to bring down ticket prices, for example, or hold things. I mean, they try and hold season ticket prices in a number of the clubs, but there are no mega fan initiatives. And I think it's a golden opportunity for sponsor brands, for example, to look at that territory. It's often overlooked. I remember Carling trying to do it with, you know, they've tried to do it with free travel for away fans and all the rest of it, and subsidised tickets. So there's been little initiatives here and there, but nothing that's massively cut through.
You know what's coming across to me here, Steve, just listening to you? How much do you think football is becoming a different property from other sports? I've been listening to you guys and golf and Formula One and rugby.
I think you talk about football because of the sheer scale of it.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's a demographic thing. And I think because the demographic's different, I think the whole sponsorship and broadcasting playbook, I think, is becoming different. You know, like the sponsors you're talking about here in football, they don't exist. The betting one, you know, you say, I tend to think it's betting because that's their demographic. It's not that they need to get awareness.
Do you think, are you saying that you don't think that football is as well served by sponsors as other sports?
I'm not saying well served is the right term, because that means it's as if they're kind of like they're to blame. I think that the sponsorship industry has clocked what football is. And I know we had a laugh earlier, and maybe we'll cut it out because it's inappropriate, but I think the sponsorship industry has clocked what the football fan is. There's only a certain amount that are able to take a sophisticated message, and the other part of the demographic can take another message, which is around the addiction business. I'm saying it to be provocative. Alcohol, cigarettes, betting. And the more I hear about it, speaking, you're so sophisticated around the other sports, I'm not sure football is an outlier.
You see, I would say that's quite a local view of it, and I get it. I would agree with that. I think globally it's almost the opposite. So you look at World Cups and Champions League, you know, they're big prime time global sponsor brands, really. And you're seeing the sort of FIFA World Cup completely change with many of the Chinese and Asian brands coming on board, and will play catch up. But you know, it's a huge media buy for them, and a presence I think they're trying to create, and credibility locally. I would say absolutely you agree. If you to look across the Premier League, for example, as it sits at the moment, you tell me who the big partners are.
Yeah.
And then you take that down even more domestically through to the Scottish Premier League, for example, or the Scottish leagues. Can you tell me? So it's quite a domestic view. And I mean, I'm not sure what the view is around La Liga. And
I'm not sure that that's 100% true. I mean, if you look at, so, you know, your club, obviously Standard Chartered, Spurs, AIA, up until recently, you know, still Emirates with Arsenal. It is true probably at the middle and lower end, but I mean, I think once you've created a decent brand as a club, there are still those opportunities for great brands.
Sorry, I was talking about leagues and federations. I think, you know, you go FIFA,
or maybe to Roger, more to Roger's point, is that, you know, I have to be a bit careful, because, you know, we've signed a betting partner. We have a beer brand and a whiskey brand as major partners of ours.
Right, as you should.
I think the key is
Spurs.
No, of Formula One.
Oh, sorry.
So I think, you know, it's where they sit in the milieu. If it's only betting and only alcohol, then there's probably a problem.
That's my point.
My question would be then, within football, I'm interested in all of your points of view, is so you have the betting brands, say Premier League, there's a lot of betting involved. Then you have companies like Standard Chartered who come in. My sense is Liverpool are having the time of their lives. I don't necessarily see that Standard Chartered are necessarily becoming the I don't know what they're doing. I suspect it's all in Asia.
Focus in Asia. And they're about to renew and, you know, X percentage more deal. I think they're very much those live examples. I agree.
AIA so being the other big, for your big,
you know, I mean, it's all about Asia. It shows the globalisation of
Well,
Premier League,
well again, let me press you on this, because I tend to think that we're sitting here in London talking about this, and I think London sometimes makes a mistake that doesn't realise that outside, especially outside London, and okay, Manchester, you go to a place like Newcastle, Middlesbrough, certainly up in Scotland, you don't have an Asian play. I don't think you have got an Asian play. And I think when you strip away the sexiness of London, you strip away the sexiness of the Premier League, and it's just football the way you understand football, I think it's not particularly appealing for sponsors, and the data shows that, the facts show that. There's no serious sponsor around what I would call normal working class community football.
I don't agree with that at all. I mean, Premier League is the most successful league in the world at the moment.
No, that's what I'm
way.
Saying. If
I
you
mean,
take the Premier League away, if you take the Premier League away, you take Derby County, not in the Premier League. You know, what can they aspire to in terms of sponsors? I would say it's the usual brands. It's betting, it's alcohol, it's... And I tend to think that this comes into the whole polarisation side of certainly football, where you guys in England with the Premiership, you're the best league in the world, and it's hidden a little bit the polarisation that's happening between the clubs that are going to be part of this global Asian vision and the ones that were around in the 70s.
It's all a precursor to closed leagues, isn't it?
Maybe that's what I'm getting to.
Well, what does this mean, though, with Luton Town recently very noisily turning down a betting sponsor? You know, they were offered the money from a betting company to put on the shirts, and they turned it down, saying that we need to push back against betting and alcohol and all these...
What do they have instead?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that's even been announced yet, but... But, I mean, they made a big fuss about, hey, we're doing this. Is that self-serving, or is that the thin end of a sort of a turn in the wedge, do you think?
I kind of think, here's another provocative idea. I think shirt sponsorship in football, I think it could disappear. I think that a sponsor is much more interested in football in an engaged conversation with a certain part of the database that can be segmented, i.e. who's going to buy a car in the next 12 months. And if you said to them, look, you know, if I take the off the shirt and I give you that, would you be interested in that?
You can never give a sponsor less than he got in the past. I think that's the number one rule.
And also the market will be the market. You know, there's a market that's created for these things. And if nobody buys them, then nobody will buy them. But they are buying them.
Yeah.
And they're buying them through... whatever need, but they're all individual markets. There are many markets going on the whole time. The betting thing is really interesting because obviously there's a huge rebellion going on within the industry. Obviously the kickback on the broadcasters being able to take betting brands within games is all changing, which is going to have a huge commercial impact on a lot of those big broadcasters. That there's going to be no betting ads around live broadcasts. So that is going to change significantly and quite... I mean, that's particularly in and around football. So, you know, and there's also that, I think it comes back in the macro issue, particularly dealing and marketing towards a male audience about mental health.
Yeah.
You know, mental health is incredibly topical across all audiences. They're using sport to communicate that. You know, there's going to be a huge campaign about gamble awareness coming out very, very soon about just the mental issue around gambling and the procedure you go through to actually put on a bet, but then the regrets around that. So this has all risen over the last 3 or 4 years. I think there's been an absolute saturation in this market. For example, you only need to turn on the broadcasters here around football in particular, and it's betting, betting, betting. I think somebody counted there were 15 betting ads within a one-hour broadcast. Now, that's just extraordinary. And the kickback has started to happen. So it'll be very interesting to see where that goes and whether that then has a knock-on effect on the market. But the splintering of betting companies and new brands within betting is amazing. And they're all trying to fight for noise and trying to fight for awareness. Hence, you know, one of the biggest drivers in sports sponsorship from an awareness point of view is shirt sponsors.
I thought I was watching a Ray Winston box set the other week, and it was actually a Premier League game. I haven't seen so much of him for years. Well, I tell you what, let's pause for a second because we've got tea and cakes here stuff. So let's step back from the business side a bit. And while we're just having tea and cakes, go back to just being fans.
Well, as the tea gets placed on the table, we're going to leave it there for this week. But you're in for a real treat with the second and the third episodes of this conversation. Here's a little sneak peek of what you're in for over the next couple of weeks.
And then in terms of event, it was actually the Liverpool AC Milan Champions League final in Istanbul, which, again, because I didn't have any skin in the game, I was able to appreciate it for the sheer drama and theatre it was. And there were lots of sort of ancillary things around it which made it such a special event for me. You know, I grew up in Turkey, so it was great to see it in Turkey. It was about 2 hours before the game, I found a spare ticket for my dad, who happened to be in Istanbul, never seen a professional football match in his life. That was his first ever professional football match.
He doesn't need to go to another one, really.
And so that match actually brought me to tears because it was just such an emotional thing, and you could see how much it meant and sort of the ebb and flow of it and the drama. I mean, that's what you
I actually watched
for,
it last night. Can you believe that? I watched Steven Gerrard's documentary last night that Amazon created. I tried to watch it the last 3 or 4 weeks over Christmas, but it was very interesting to see that through his lens as well.
Ed Smith talks about this a lot. They say that the racehorse reached physical perfection in the 50s, and there has been now no difference in time between the racehorse running in the 50s to now. So whether doing the Derby loop, the horses aren't getting fast because that balance of muscle versus lightness of bone has reached a point. So there's the optimum sports person. What we're living through is that human beings have not reached the optimal level of sport. It's getting closer. And therefore, if you take a rugby player like Gareth Edwards, who at his time in the 70s, he was the junior British sprint champion, low hurdles, whatever they were, 110-yard hurdles. He would be considered as great an athlete and at his time as a rugby player right up there. But right now, obviously not now, he's 74, but he wouldn't come close. But at his time, he was. So I always get rather disappointed when people start to say, who's the greatest? I love the argument because it really allows the pints to flow. It doesn't really matter.
Sport is a truly global property, and actually then you can get closer to the All Blacks, you can get closer to these other properties because of that digitalization of everything. So there's pros and cons, and again it's very subjective, the good, the bad and the ugly of it, but you can't get away from actually that younger market of, you know, from a demographic point of view, are completely engaged in international sports. Why do you think NBA has been so successful? Why do you think NFL has had a huge growth spurt? Because not only are they just landing here, and that's not just about landing in this market, but it's incredibly accessible. And it's incredibly accessible on your time. That never was. You know, you think in our era, you're talking about Michael Jordan watching him. I can remember watching him. I never didn't grow up with him because I was too busy watching Alex Higgins.
Well, there you go, Rog. So much to look forward to. You and I have heard the conversation a couple of times already, and I know I'm looking forward to hearing it again. But that's all we've got time for this week. So before we go, just a reminder to please download the podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes, tell a friend a week, and drag them into the crowd with us, and we'll see if we can't build up a stadium-sized fan base for this product. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you'll find us at EntertainedR. That's Entertained A-R-E, the word, not the letter. And if you feel that way inclined, you can follow me on Twitter also at TTMYGH.
And if you want to follow myself, it's RPM Como, as in Lake Como.
As in the lake. Rog, again, another week. A lot of fun. And we'll talk next week.
Thanks, sir. Take care. Bye-bye.